From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In the first place, I don't think they will get the resolution. Second place, even if they do get the resolution, I don't think it helps very much, because the resolution of the United Nations cannot make right what is otherwise wrong. You should not embark on military action, which inevitably involves the risk of the death of many individuals, unless you can establish a good moral basis for doing that.
A conservative member of the British Parliament speaks out against war a day after Prime Minister Tony Blair says Britain will deploy troops with or without UN backing. We will also speak with Tony Benn. He has served in the British Parliament for more than half a century. But first, Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic is assassinated. We'll go to Belgrade. And what if the General Assembly takes the ball from the court of the Security Council? We'll look at Uniting for Peace, a little-known United Nations resolution. Could it stop a war? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Serbia is under a state of emergency today following the assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. He was the chief organizer of the October 2000 Democratic Revolution that toppled Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He became the head of Serbia's first non-communist government in January 2001. Djindjic was gunned down yesterday morning by unknown assailants in a sniper attack in broad daylight outside a Serbian government building in Belgrade. We'll go to Belgrade in a few minutes. The U.S. Supreme Court last night granted a stay of execution to death row prisoner Delma Banks just 15 minutes before Texan officials were set to kill him by lethal injection. The justices said he should be kept alive in order for them to consider his request for a full hearing. Banks has long claimed his 1980 trial was marred by prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective defense, and racially discriminatory jury selection. Banks is an African-American man convicted of killing a white teenager by an all-white jury. Former FBI Director William Sessions, among others, have rallied behind Banks' case. New York City yesterday became the 141st city and town in the country to pass a resolution condemning a war in Iraq. The nation's three largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, have now all passed anti-war resolutions. The Bush administration claimed yesterday it was within close range of majority support for a UN resolution to attack Iraq. This according to a report in the Washington Post. Five council members, including France and Russia, have said publicly they will not support what they see as an unjustified rush to war, while only four, the United States, Britain, Spain, and Bulgaria, are publicly behind it. The U.S. has refused to state what other countries are backing them. Britain proposed yesterday that six specific demands to Iraq be attached to a new UN Security Council resolution. The White House has remained noncommittal on the compromise. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who desperately needs another resolution because of rising opposition to war in his Labour Party and government, announced the six tests yesterday in the House of Commons in London. He said Saddam Hussein must make a public statement to be broadcast in Iraq and outside, admitting he has weapons of mass destruction and will give them up. Allow 30 Iraqi scientists to be interviewed outside Iraq with their families in tow. Surrender stocks of anthrax and other biological and chemical agents, which UN weapons inspectors said Iraq had in 1998, or produce documents to demonstrate what happened to them. Pledge to destroy banned missiles. Account for unmanned aerial vehicles, known as drones, which can spray chemical agents over wide areas. Give a commitment to hand over all mobile bioproduction laboratories for destruction. International relief organizations in the Middle East say they have neither sufficient supplies nor enough money to cope with the millions of injured, displaced, and starving people that could result in a war in Iraq. They fear at least half of the Iraqi population of 25 million might be left struggling for food and water. And after days of media speculation that Iraq had developed a high-tech pilotless drone warplane, foreign journalists are now saying the fear may have been quite overstated. A New York Times reporter who saw the alleged drone compared it to the Wright Brothers plane. The paper reports, resting on trestles on a sidewalk, the drone seemed like a sad, patched-together affair. Its two tiny engines, each about the size of a whiskey bottle, and attached to minuscule wooden propellers, looked about powerful enough to drive a weed whacker, as one wag present suggested. Like a primitive biplane from the earliest days of flight, its wings and twin tail fins were made of wood and stretched fabric, swaths of plastic masking tape covered the wing joints. Iran and Iraq have agreed to release all remaining prisoners from the country's war that ended in 1988. Iran is set to release 941 Iraqi prisoners of war, while Iraq will free 349 Iranians. The Philippine military has killed at least 16 members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in airstrikes in the southern Philippines. A Turkish court has banned the country's main Kurdish party, the People's Democratic Party. The court also banned 46 members of the party, including the former chair, from politics for 5 years. The court claimed the party had been aiding the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which had been previously outlawed. The move follows a ruling on Wednesday by the European Court of Human Rights that the Turkish authorities violated the human rights of Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, who is serving a life sentence. And Japan has sent a battleship to the Sea of Japan amid media reports that North Korea could be preparing another missile test. An Air Force base in Texas responsible for training intelligence specialists and firefighters experienced a surge in cases last year following sex between instructors and students, this according to Air Force officials. This resulted in court-martial proceedings against 4 instructors and 1 student. The disclosure comes in the wake of reports of dozens of rapes and sexual assaults in the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke was sentenced yesterday for more than a year in prison and $10,000 fine for tax and mail fraud.
Like the salmon on the mountain, says the Dharma got dumb. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns. When we're pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Jacob's Ladder, Chumbawamba, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Serbia is under a state of emergency today following the assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. He was the chief organizer of the October 2000 revolution that toppled Slobodan Milosevic. He became head of Serbia's first non-communist government in January 2001. Djindjic was gunned down yesterday morning by unknown assailants in a sniper attack in broad daylight outside a Serbian government building in Belgrade. The Serbian government accused a gang led by a former commander of the Serbian Special Police Unit of carrying out the killing in a bid to end a crackdown on organized crime. Serbian President Natasa Micic said the state of emergency will remain in force until both the perpetrators of the assassination have been arrested. BBC reports as many as 20 people are wanted for questioning. Radio B92 said 2 people had been arrested following the attack, the second in less than a month, against Djindjic. Djindjic first became known in 1974 when he was jailed by Tito, for attempting to organize an independent student union. He later became one of the founders of the Democratic Party, eventually becoming the party president. He later joined the Serbian parliament in the upper house of the federal parliament. We're joined right now by two people in Belgrade. We're joined by Stojan Serovic, who is a columnist for the Serbian magazine Vreme, which means time in English. And Vesna Peric-Zimonjic is a journalist and reporter for the independent newspaper in London. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Vesna? Can you talk about what happened yesterday and what is happening in Belgrade today?
Well, in Belgrade today, there was just a few minutes ago the commemorial service and the ceremony for the for Mr. Dinčić ended at the headquarters of his Democratic Party. It was a very emotional ceremony, but the officials of his party vowed to continue his politics and to fight all the battles that that might come in the parliament. So, meaning sticking to the road to the democracy which Mr. Dinčić tried to establish in Serbia.
Can you talk about what's known about who killed him?
I'm sorry, this line is very bad. This line is very bad. I hear you very poorly.
Can you talk about what's known about who killed him?
Well, for the time being, the government and most of the analysts still think that it is the organized group, the so-called Zemun clan, of the criminals in Belgrade who were involved in the killing of Mr. Dinčić. Vice Prime Minister of Serbia, Mr. Žarko Korać, said earlier today that some arrests have been made in the town of Belgrade, but the key figures, like Mr. Luković or Legia that you mentioned, are at large, still at large, or hiding somewhere in Serbia.
I want to turn now to Stojan Serovic. Can you just give us now an analysis of what this means for Serbian politics today?
Can you say it again, please?
An analysis for where Serbia goes now, what it will mean for Serbian politics and the turn it will take.
Yes. Well, I think that in the first place we have now a problem of stabilizing the situation. I think that there is this major concern in the political elite of how to control the situation and how to keep people quiet and create the sense that things are under control, since this, the institutions of the country are actually very fragile. And I think that the assassination of Prime Minister Dinčić is actually a great loss. And I guess that many people are afraid of some kind of anarchic movements that things might fall apart and that that there will be no monopoly of the force and power, and that we might end up in a kind of chaos with the different police or military units fighting each other and things like that. I mean, it's the worst kind of scenario, which is hopefully not very likely to happen, but I guess that's the first thing that our political elite has in mind. Now, I would say that in the long run, we will proceed in the same direction. I think that it's not just Mr. Dinčić, but many others who are pushing toward the westernization and modernization of Serbia. But Dinčić, it's true that Dinčić was extremely important, and actually the most important and the best, and the brightest among all those pro-reform politicians, and in that sense he is indispensable.
Vesna, what about his enemies, Dinčić's enemies, who he took on, who took him on. For example, he was blasted by Serbian nationalists, including his former ally, Kostunica, who stepped down as Yugoslav president earlier this month after the formation of the new states, Serbia and Montenegro.
Certainly, Mr. Dinčić and his energetic politics did have a lot of enemies. First of all, that would be the nationalist circles. I would say hardliners and those people who sympathized with the former regime of Mr. Slobodan Milošević. They were on one side. They are one part of the enemies that Mr. Dinčić could have. The other part is certainly the softer nationalist option, like Mr. Kostunica. But Mr. Kostunica, the former president of Yugoslavia, expressed his astonishment at the after the assassination of Mr. Dinčić and said that it's high time that the country got hold control of the situation and the government got control of the situation in Serbia. But most of all, it is the organized crime, which can be linked to the, as which can be described as a remnant of the old regime. The people who were left after October 5th and the fall of Mr. Milošević from power, who were left in the in their positions, later left their positions, but couldn't take off their hands of the lucrative business like smuggling operations and abductions of important people in Serbia.
The New York Times has a piece today that says Serbs killing is setback for war crimes tribunal, talking about the assassination of the prime minister being seen as a setback at the United Nations tribunal appointed to try crimes of Yugoslavia's wars, where prosecutors regarded Dinčić as their best hope to deliver important Serbian fugitives indicted by the court. Stojan Serovic, would you comment?
Well, I must say that I agree. I think that Dinčić was under too strong pressure to hand so many indictees to Hague, you know, as soon as possible. And it seems that some people that police mentioned as the members of this Zemun clan, who people who are probably responsible for this assassination, they were also indicted by Hague. Or at least they believe that they might be, and they also believe that Dinčić might decide eventually to hand them to Hague. So it seems that this strong pressure from the Hague tribunal was simply too strong, and that I'm afraid that it's well, that it really did help you know, to some of those people to find the motives and money to organize this assassination. I would say that it was Hague Tribunal, Mrs. Del Ponte was not sensitive enough of the Serbian political reality.
And finally, what does it mean for Serbia to be under a state of emergency today?
Well, it means that some civil rights and liberties has been suspended, and the police got a freer hand to, you know, exercise some measures against this the suspects. It's not that people are too afraid of this. I think that people basically accepted this pretty quietly, as far as I can see. And my guess is that there is more of fear that that we might end up in some kind of anarchy and more violence. So people are just pretty calm with an emergency state. It seems that people are not afraid of any kind of military coup or things like that.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. again on this day after the assassination of the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. We've been speaking with Stojan Cerovic of the Serbian magazine Vreme and Vesna Peric Zimonjic, who is a journalist for the independent newspaper in London. They're both based in Belgrade. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear from a conservative British parliamentarian and Tony Benn, the longest-serving member of parliament, served there for more than half a century. Stay with us.
Boys and girls, London calling. Now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling. See, we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming. The sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected. The wheat is going thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear. 'Cause London is drowning. I live by the river to the imitation zone.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has told Parliament British forces will join a U.S. invasion of Iraq even if a majority of the U.N. Security Council does not endorse an attack. The Guardian of London calls it the biggest political gamble of his life. Blair is facing massive public opposition to an invasion of Iraq within his own Labour Party, opposition parties, and the public. On Tuesday, Donald Rumsfeld sparked a furor when he suggested for the first time Blair might not be able to support a U.S. invasion due to British public opinion. Rumsfeld said he would not count on going to war without Britain. He said Britain's role in an invasion is, quote, unclear. On Sunday, one of Britain's most powerful cabinet ministers dealt a powerful blow to Blair. International Development Secretary Claire Short called Blair's behavior reckless and said she will resign if Blair commits British troops without UN backing in violation of international law. In a minute, we're going to go to Tony Benn, the longest-serving member of Parliament in British history, former chair of the Labour Party. But we first turn to a member of Parliament with the opposition Conservative Party. Douglas Hogg is also foreign minister during the 1991 Gulf War with responsibility for Middle East policy. He supported that war, but is speaking out against this one. Our senior producer, Chris Abrams, asked Hogg for his response to Blair's announcement he will commit British troops with or without UN backing.
Well, that will be greeted with considerable dismay in the British Parliament, and I think in the United Kingdom generally. I have no doubt that the British forces will in fact play a part in this coming campaign, but many people feel that there is no sufficient justification for war.
How do you feel about war with Iraq?
I don't think there is a sufficient justification for it. I think that we should have pursued the policies which have been pursued since from 1991 onwards, relying primarily on deterrence. And I think that the crucial error that the American and United Kingdom administrations made was in the autumn of last year, when it was decided to make the further disarmament of Iraq by force if necessary a strategic objective of policy. Everything that has followed is the consequence of that, and that was an error.
If Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, do you believe he is a threat to the U.S. or Britain?
No, I don't. I'm perfectly willing to assume that he does have weapons of mass destruction. Anyway, he has the capacity to develop them, and he's done so in the past. So there's no real dispute between us on that point. But the question is whether he is a threat. And here I think the answer is no, or at least not a sufficient threat to justify war. The plain truth is that since 1991, he has largely been contained in his box. He's a bloody-minded ruler, and one would like to see him go. but he doesn't actually constitute a threat to his immediate neighbors, nor to other countries in the world, because he knows full well that if he was to attack his neighbors or attack anybody else, he would be the subject of military retaliation of a massive kind, which would be justified.
Why do you think military action against Iraq is not justified?
Because you should not embark on military action, which inevitably involves the risk of the death of many individuals, unless you can establish a good moral basis for doing that. Now, in the modern world, the best moral basis, perhaps only the only moral basis, is self-defense. Now, you give self-defense a fairly enlarged meaning. You don't have to wait to be attacked. Of course, I accept that. But you do have to be able to say in honesty that the country against which you take the preemptive action constitutes a real threat to world peace or to its immediate neighbors. And I actually don't believe that that is true of Iraq. It has been so in the past, but isn't that true now?
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the past. You were a foreign minister during the 1991 Gulf War, which you supported?
Indeed, I was the minister of state, that is, effectively the deputy minister responsible for Gulf War policy.
And why did you support that war and not this one?
Because it was clear that the war was a moral one. In that case, as you will know, of course, Iraq invaded Kuwait. That was the invasion of a sovereign state. The principles of self-defense and of international law come into play. Self-defense includes the defense of your allies. Kuwait was an ally which had been invaded, and it was clear as a pikestaff that you were entitled to use military force to throw Iraq out of Kuwait. And that's what happened.
We are hearing reports now that the Bush administration is trying its hardest. It's going all out with Tony Blair to get 9 or even 8 votes for a new UN Security Council resolution. They say that this would give them a moral legitimacy, even if France or Russia vetoes the resolution. Your response?
Well, I don't agree with that. In the first place, I don't think they will get the resolution. Second place, even if they do get the resolution, I don't think it helps very much, because the resolution of the United Nations cannot make right what is otherwise wrong. It's possible that it might provide legal cover, but it really cannot make right what is otherwise wrong. And if there isn't a moral basis for war, then all the resolutions of the United Nations don't provide one. But also, it's going to be a pretty impoverished resolution, isn't it? Let's assume that you do get 8 or 9 states signing up. Big ones, such as China, Russia, France, and Germany, will not sign up under any circumstances. And furthermore, some of the countries whose votes will be obtained will have been bullied or bought. So it's not much of an authority. Let me say at once, so there's no possible doubt about it, I am very pro-American. I am by no means anti-American. My grandmother came from Tennessee. My daughter lives in Washington, D.C. I am a very strong supporter of the American alliance.
There's an article in the New York Times today that reports how French business executives are increasingly scared to come to the United States because of anti-French sentiment.
They should grow up.
Your response to the U.S. House...
They should grow up.
Your response to the U.S. House of Representatives vote to ban the word French from its cafeteria menus so that they're...
I didn't know that they did that, but they should grow up too. We can't... We really shouldn't have this... a personal and acrimonious debate as between the member states. The position of France, I happen to agree with. I think that it's been put in a pretty abrasive way. But then you'll forgive me observing that Secretary Rumsfeld has been pretty abrasive too. And the plain truth is that reasonable-minded people should be able to differ on a matter of this importance in a civil way, and that is true both of the American politicians and of the European politicians. We must not poor-mouth one another.
That was Douglas Hogg, a British member of parliament with the Conservative Party, interviewed by Democracy Now! Senior producer Chris Abrams. He was for the Gulf War. He's opposed to a U.S.-UK invasion of Iraq now. Well, Tony Blair made a last-ditch effort yesterday to secure a new U.N. Security Council resolution on Iraq, unveiling a list of actions that Saddam Hussein must carry out to avoid war. But in the wake of France's decision to veto a second resolution in any circumstances, it is increasingly unlikely that a resolution will pass. In London, deep pessimism on the British Prime Minister's part over whether the UK will muster the 9 votes it needs at the Security Council for a majority. Speculation is mounting there that the US and UK would launch a strike on Iraq this weekend if they fail to secure the resolution. We are joined now by Tony Benn, longest-serving member of the Parliament, former Secretary of State, and former chair of the Labour Party. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, I was very interested in what Douglas Hogg said, because he was putting a traditional conservative view that you only go to war if your interests are threatened, and he put that very clearly. But what it does indicate, and should indicate to people listening to this program, is that opposition to the war goes right across the whole political spectrum. Sir Edward Heath, who was Conservative Prime Minister, is against the war. Douglas Hurd, who was the Secretary of State, is against the war, and so on. And this is not a left v. right in any sense. It is a quite different division, I think, between those who believe that the United Nations Charter holds out the best hope for the survival of the human race, and those who believe that the old idea that the strongest can exert their will without any opposition. Those are the two ideas that are in conflict. And I attended a huge conference in London, a People's Assembly. It must have been a bit like the convention in Philadelphia, in effect saying, we hold these truths to be self-evident. You know what I mean? It's a big, broad political opposition to this war.
I wanted to play for a minute the interview, a small portion of the interview that you did with Saddam Hussein.
Oh, yes.
Tony Benn went to Iraq and was granted an interview. And we're going to play just an excerpt of that right now.
There are tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people in America, in Britain, in Europe and worldwide, who want to see a peaceful outcome to this problem. And they are the real Americans, in my opinion, the real British, the real French, the real Germans, because they think of the world in terms of their children. I have 10 grandchildren. And in my family, there is English, Scottish, American, French, Irish, Jewish, Indian, Muslim blood. And for me, politics is about their future, their survival. And I wondered whether you would say something yourself, direct, through this interview, to the peace movement in the world that might help to advance the cause that they have in mind.
First of all, I would like to say that we admire the development of the different peace movements in the world during the last few years. And we pray God to empower all those who are working in the world against war and for the cause of peace and security that are based on justice for all. And through you, I would like to tell the British people that Iraqis don't hate the British people. And before 1991, Iraq was leading normal relationships with Britain as well as with America. At that time, the British governments did not have any negative comments towards Iraq, as we're hearing some voices doing nowadays. We hope that the British people will tell those who hate Iraqis and want to harm them, that there is no reason to do that. I would like you to tell the British people, and please do tell the British people that they are a brave people and that the Iraqis are brave too, because every great civilization is great. And I know that all the people of the world wish to live in peace. Iraqis want the world to live in peace.
And that was Saddam Hussein speaking with the former member of the British Parliament, Tony Benn, who is on the line with us right now. This interview got hardly any attention in the United States. And when it did, it basically described you as a sympathizer with Saddam Hussein. Yeah. Your response?
Well, I mean, the view I take of Saddam is as a dictator. And I opposed him when he used chemical weapons. And when we raised it with the then government, they said, oh, no, Saddam is an ally. And after all, Donald Rumsfeld himself was in Baghdad in 1983 at a time that the components for chemical weapons were being sold by the United States to Saddam himself. And the whole story is so hypocritical, really, because the Iran-Iraq war was sponsored, if you like, by the United States. They armed Saddam, and right up until the invasion of Kuwait, he was seen as an ally. So none of the arguments really have much resonance with the British audience, because most people in Britain do remember that.
What about, I was looking at the Financial Times and the speculation mounting that if the U.S. and Britain do not get the resolution that they want, the second resolution, that they could launch a strike on Iraq as early as this weekend?
Well, I've heard that said. Of course, nobody knows, because only the Pentagon would know or the White House would know. But my own reading of the situation is that the decision to invade Iraq goes back right to the time of 9/11 and maybe even earlier for a variety of reasons. I mean, the Iraqis are the one country in the Middle East that doesn't recognize the right of Israel to exist. And I think the Israelis have been pressing for an attack upon Iraq. I heard President Bush's speech to the United Nations General Assembly on television. I watched every minute of it. And it was an ultimatum, not really to Saddam, but to the General Assembly. President Bush said, I'm going to attack Iraq. Come with me if you like. But whether you do or you don't come with me, I'm going to do it. So after I heard that speech, I never believed a word I was told by Prime Minister Blair that this was Saddam's last chance to disarm and all that. I think the war was settled months and months ago. And you don't send a quarter of a million troops out there and bring them back if Saddam suddenly produces a little bit of anthrax and apologizes for concealing it and all that. This is a strategic decision to topple Iraq, a regime change, and I think if people don't understand that, they really are misled by all the talk about second resolutions and all that. So that's the basis of my understanding of the situation, and whether the war begins at this weekend, as it could do, or next week, or sometime in a few days beyond that, it is clearly a war that the president has decided upon.
Do you think this could take Tony Blair down?
Well, you see, I thought this is where the Rumsfeld speech, which was later clarified, to use that marvelous phrase used about everything Reagan used to say, I think Rumsfeld really put his finger on it. What he was saying, in effect, to the American people, we don't need British armed forces because we're the most powerful country in the world, but we do welcome British political support. And so Tony Blair, in order to allegedly to gain some influence, and I doubt if he has any influence in the White House at all, but in order to do that, he offered to send 50,000 British troops and an aircraft carrier and a few fighter planes, which are not needed for the destruction of Iraq at all. And President Bush is grateful for it, and the American people see Blair as an ally. But Rumsfeld, by saying we don't need you militarily, really revealed that with startling clarity. And one or two people in Britain have said since Rumsfeld's speech, well, if the Americans don't need us, why are we involved anyway? And that has put the Prime Minister in a second difficulty, because he's always made out, A, that he was doing it in support of an old ally, and also because our troops are needed. And neither of those are really the true story.
Tony Benn, there is this scandal that is brewing that has gotten almost no attention in the United States that came out in the London Observer last Sunday about this National Security Agency memo that directs intelligence to bug the home and office phones, emails, faxes of UN Security Council diplomats to find out, you know, how they're strategizing, which way they're going on a resolution with Iraq. It's gotten almost no attention here. But then this past weekend, you saw the arrest of a 28-year-old woman in GSHQ in British intelligence, and is believed it is directly connected to this. What kind of attention is this getting in Britain, and where is this going? The question is, would it also lead to arrests of reporters like Martin Bright, who reported this story, since it is a crime in Britain either to divulge top secret information or to disseminate it?
Well, it did get big coverage in The Observer, which is widely read, so everyone who studies the news would know it. I personally am not at all surprised. I mean, part of my responsibilities in the past, when I was the minister in charge of the nuclear policy, I knew perfectly well that the United States bugs everybody they want in America and here, and we have an arrangement with them that the United States lends us nuclear warheads if we allow them to supervise our intelligence services. So I wasn't a bit surprised. It may have shocked some members of the Security Council who didn't know what was going on. But you see, this is back to sort of medieval politics, when we had a king but no parliament. Kings bribed and bullied people and opened people's letters and so on. And I think the political lesson of this, if I may draw one new conclusion, is that when you discover that your own government, and I'm talking about the British government now, ignores the UN, which is responsible for international law, ignores Parliament, ignores the party Mr. Blair leads, ignores the public, it releases us from our moral obligation to do what we are told. And I think you are going to find in Europe and in Britain, you're going to find acts of civil disobedience and action, direct action, to stop the war if it begins. Now, normally when that happens, you say, well, don't do that. Elect someone you want and he'll represent you in Parliament. But if Parliament is ignored and the UN is ignored, then conscience comes back into play. And the more I look at all this scene, the more I am reminded of the stories I read in my school books about Charlemagne and Napoleon and so on. This is the way that powerful generals and leaders behaved. And it's nothing whatever to do with the Charter of the UN, which I think is our only hope for the survival of the human race. I mean, I couldn't put it more strongly than that. So what you say about the bugging is just an illumination, rather like the bribing that Douglas Hogg referred to. You know, you go to some country and you offer them help if they'll support you in a resolution to attack somebody else, and they have no interest in the matter. And I think it has discredited America very, very substantially. And if I were President of the United States, I think I'd rather be popular than exercise my power in this very crude way.
Well, Tony Benn, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I also wanted to finally ask you about the British proposal being put forward that would add 6 demands to a UN Security Council resolution that Saddam make a public statement to be broadcast in and outside Iraq, admitting he has weapons of mass destruction, will give them up, allow 30 Iraqi scientists to be interviewed outside Iraq with their families in tow, surrender stocks of anthrax and other biological chemical agents, or produce documents to demonstrate what happened to them, pledge to destroy banned missiles, give a commitment to hand over all mobile bioproduction laboratories for destruction, account for unmanned aerial vehicles known as drones that can spray chemical agents over wide areas.
Well, I read or heard yesterday, you will correct me if I'm wrong, that the American administration had declined to give support for that resolution. Perhaps they're afraid it might be carried and would delay the war that the president has decided upon. But it is not a proposal at all. I heard Brzezinski, who was, after all, a very senior former defense advisor, saying it was rather provocative. And I don't think it's a serious resolution. I think that Mr. Blair is just looking for anything that could justify him for voting for something, and then when it failed, say, well, I had no choice but to go on with going alongside the president. But it isn't a serious proposal. And as a matter of fact, the British contribution to all these discussions has been quite fraudulent. You know, we put in a dossier. Turned out it had been picked up on the internet from a PhD thesis by an Iraqi student in 1997 and then dressed up by the Prime Minister's press office. And there was an accusation that the Iraqi government had imported uranium from Africa, and Blix said it was it was not authentic. You know the old saying, truth is the first casualty in war, and at the moment truth in this area is in intensive care permanently. Nobody believes a word they're told. And I can understand it, because what we're being told is designed to persuade us that this is the right course, when most people in their heart of hearts know it isn't. So I think, therefore, the latest British proposal, if it weren't so serious, I would say it was laughable. But it is, of course, designed to persuade the British people that a lot of innocent Iraqis should be killed, many of whom would be critical of Saddam.
Tony Benn, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Tony Benn, longest member of the British Parliament, served for 51 years. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
People meeting in churches, people walking in the park, people shouting out at noon, people whispering in the dark. Say, ain't gonna fight your war, ain't gonna fight your war, no, ain't gonna fight your foolish war. I'm on the glory road. Ain't gonna fight your war, ain't gonna fight your war, no, ain't gonna fight your foolish war. I'm on the glory road. The people walking on the sidewalks, people driving in their cars, people talking in restaurants.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about a novel approach that some lawyers, civil rights, and environmentalists are taking, spearheading an effort to stop the war by invoking a little-known UN resolution called Uniting for Peace. Under the procedure, the UN General Assembly can demand an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal. Resolution 377 was adopted by the Security Council so that the UN can act even if the Security Council is stalemated by vetoes. Resolution 377 states that if there is a, quote, threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and the permanent members of the Security Council can't agree on action, the General Assembly can convene and recommend measures to, quote, maintain or restore international peace and security. The Uniting for Peace mechanism has been used 10 times. It was most recently invoked by the United States. When Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal in 1956, Britain, France, and Israel invaded Egypt and began advancing on the Suez Canal. U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower demanded the invasion stop. Resolutions in the U.N. Security Council called for a ceasefire, but Britain and France vetoed them. Then the U.S. appealed to the General Assembly and proposed a resolution calling for a ceasefire and a withdrawal of forces. The General Assembly held an emergency session and passed the resolution. Britain and France withdrew from Egypt within a week. We're joined right now by two people who've been meeting with UN delegations about this little-known resolution. Stephen Sawyer is with us, political advisor for Greenpeace International. Michael Ratner, president for Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome both.
Good morning.
Welcome, Amy.
Well, the question of what does the Suez Canal or what Korea before that when this was invoked, what does that have to do with what we're seeing now? Why can this be used, this Uniting for Peace resolution?
Well, the basic principle behind the resolution is that the matters of international peace and security are, under ordinary circumstances, the exclusive purview of the Security Council. But if the Security Council demonstrates itself unable to deal with them, as seems to be the most likely outcome in this circumstance, then the only recourse within the UN system is to invoke Resolution 377, get a majority of the members of the General Assembly to call for an emergency session, and pass resolutions making demands or giving advice or instructions to members or other branches of the UN to try to resolve the situation. And in the face of this unbridled attack on multilateralism by the US and the UK, we think it would not only be a potentially effective tool to at least convince some people that this rush to war is misguided, but would also give some signs of strength for the UN itself.
Why is there a UN Security Council and a General Assembly anyway, Michael Ratner?
Well, when they set up the United Nations, they didn't want the decisions regarding particularly the use of force to be decided by all the countries of the world. They wanted those decisions made by the five at that time deemed the most powerful countries of the world. And they've therefore essentially left that decision up to the Security Council with five members having really the power, the veto. There's a General Assembly that basically is made up of every single member state and is arguably a lot more democratic and as a way of making decisions. In this instance, it does seem to me that one of the goals here is to make whatever the United States decides to do utterly illegitimate. The Security Council either will veto in the next couple of days or not approve the use of force in some way or another. In that case, U.S. is already getting isolated. What you want to do is isolate it even more. You pull this thing into the General Assembly. You hopefully get a very lopsided vote in the General Assembly against the U.S. use of force. And at that point, you're sitting with the United States looking like a naked aggressor in the world. I think that's something that's very, very important and may actually have some effect on the conduct. It certainly begins to, like, unpeel the UK and maybe other countries that look like they might want to support the United States.
Stephen Sawyer, what are some of the delegations? Who are some of the delegations you visited?
Oh, we've visited about 30 countries by now from Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Europe. Don't seem to get any North American delegations who want to meet with us for some strange reason. We have found all but one or two, and I would categorize those as members of the New Europe, in other words, Eastern European countries who are trying to join NATO at the moment. All of them have said in one way or another that they would be very interested in entertaining such a notion, or would have said that they would in fact strongly support it if the Security Council fails to resolve the matter, which everybody thinks is the most likely outcome. I can't really name names at this point in time because these are private conversations and they don't want to nail their colors to the mast until they have to. But
and those countries that are trying to join NATO are hitching themselves up with the United States and supporting the U.S.?
Yeah, well, I mean, there was the famous letter from the Eight, who are aspiring NATO members, newly democratized or pseudo-democratized Eastern European countries, from Slovakia to Poland to Czech Republic and Slovenia and the Baltic republics. They're obviously playing a dual game at the moment, because the same ones that are both trying to join NATO are at the same time trying to gain membership to the European Union. So they're trying to keep a very low profile, except, of course, Bulgaria, which has been the only Eastern European country to support the United States outright. And they're in a bit of a difficult spot, and when push comes to shove, if the Security Council does fail, then they'll have to balance, as most governments are at the moment, the extraordinary pressure from the United States on one hand and overwhelming domestic public opposition to the war on the other.
Michael Ratner, this attempt, does it join other attempts going on right now at the United Nations, or is this the overall thrust of the opposition now?
Well, as we know, there's activities going on all over the world right now with regard to opposition to the war. The UN is one area where a lot of that activity is at least being focused, and I think the first focus, obviously, in the next day is to make sure that Security Council doesn't approve of this war. And that means giving support to those countries, particularly the three African countries, Cameroon, Angola, and Guinea, as well as Mexico and Chile, to oppose the war. Very important. Obviously support the French in their veto, and at the same time also urge countries, whether the missions here or the peoples in their in their own countries to support a Uniting for Peace resolution when the U.S. says we will go to war anyway, despite what the Security Council does. It's a big effort. The Center for Constitutional Rights has a website where we have our information on that. That's ccr-ny.org. Greenpeace also has a website, and the center worked on the draft of this. Greenpeace is really out there, I think, in a big way, doing a lot of the organizing around this, and we're really thankful to be able to work together.
I've just been hearing about something going on in Britain now, about an attempt to take Tony Blair to court if he joins the U.S. in invading Iraq. Can you explain what that is about?
Well, the lawyers from the United States, lawyers from the U.K., lawyers from Canada have said for a while that if there's an attempt to go to war here, that certainly in terms of the types of weapons used, that there will be most likely violations of the Geneva Conventions. But what's going on now in Britain is even a little different and more better than that in some ways. You know, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has gone into business as of yesterday, the day before, actually Monday, when Kofi Annan made his famous speech saying that any use of force by the United States would be a violation of the UN Charter unless the Security Council approves. But the lawyers in the UK are basically saying, if there's a war here, we're going to take Tony Blair to the International Criminal Court, not because it's an aggressive war, which they have jurisdiction over, but it hasn't been defined yet, but because anybody killed in the UK would basically be an unlawful, anybody killed by the UK cooperating with the United States in Iraq would essentially be murder and unlawful killing, and therefore they believe the ICC would have jurisdiction. There's a pretty big movement on among lawyers in both Canada and in the UK to do this.
Do you think that you can stop this war?
We have to hope, but how one reasons with or discusses with or has any impact on the people in the White House who are making these decisions and the people in the Pentagon eludes us at present. It eludes all of the governments that we've been talked to. We ask them, do you understand why George Bush is doing this? Do you have any idea? And they all come back and say, we are friends of America. We respect the American people, we respect American democracy, but we cannot understand what he is doing and why. The only thing that we know is that he is hell-bent on doing it.
I think that, as I said, I think one of the keys here, I think this can be stopped in the sense that we are making what the U.S. is doing utterly illegitimate. And I say we, I mean the broad peace movement in the world. And I think the Uniting for Peace resolution is a way of doing that. I'd like Steve to actually give the Greenpeace website, because I think that has a lot of information of how to work on this.
Yeah, well, we have been running an action alert for several weeks now, where we at www.greenpeace.org, you can find the pro forma letters to send emails and faxes to members of the Security Council, first to the five who are absolutely opposed to war, to keep the faith and hang in there, and also to the middle six, asking them to listen to their public and not to the White House and the Pentagon, and also to the Spanish, British, Americans, and Bulgarians, and opposing their position. We've had about 600,000 or 700,000 messages so far, and the next 2 days or 3 days is going to be the final push on that, and we'd like to get it up over 1 million.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Stephen Sawyer of Greenpeace, political advisor for Greenpeace International. Sawyer has spent the last 25 years working on issues from climate change to peace and disarmament issues. They have been spending the last few days speaking to various UN delegations about this Uniting for Peace resolution, which you can find on their websites. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. mail@democracynow.org. And if you'd like to find out about getting us on your television or radio station, just go to our website and you can get more information. Any public radio or television station can run Democracy Now! As we now expand to 2 hours every day dealing with issues of war and peace. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Angie Karen and Anna Noguera. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
All things and what they used to be now, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It was just exciting, you know, when I heard it. It was just exciting, and I don't have the words to explain. I'm just so thankful that he got a stay.
The mother of Delma Banks celebrates the stay of execution of her son 15 minutes before he was scheduled to die in Texas. And another family celebrated yesterday, the Smarts of Salt Lake City, on the return of their missing daughter, Elizabeth.
It's just so great. It's a miracle.
We will look at what made the difference in the case of Elizabeth Smart.
Media has played an incredible part in helping us bring her home. And I'm just so, so thankful.
What role does race play when it comes to a missing child? Who gets covered? Who doesn't? And then we'll talk to the man Pentagon advisor Richard Perl says is the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tony Blair has said today he believes a second resolution on Iraq is, quote, now probably less likely than at any time. His comments came after France opposed a British compromise that called six tests for Iraqi disarmament. Yesterday, Blair told Parliament that British forces will join a U.S. invasion of Iraq even if a majority of the U.N. Security Council does not endorse such an attack. The Guardian of London calls it the biggest political gamble of Blair's life. He is facing massive public opposition to an invasion in Iraq within his own Labour Party, opposition parties, and the public. On Tuesday, U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld sparked a furor when he suggested for the first time that Blair might not be able to support a U.S. invasion due to British public opinion. Rumsfeld said he would not count out going to war without Britain. He said Britain's role in an invasion is, quote, unclear. Serbia is under a state of emergency today following the assassination of Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. Djindjic was gunned down yesterday morning by unknown assailants in a sniper attack in broad daylight outside a Serbian government building in Belgrade. The deputy prime minister, Zarko Korac, told Belgrade's B90 radio today that despite a number of arrests overnight, the main suspects behind the assassination of the premier are still on the run. His comments came after the government accused a Belgrade-based criminal gang for the murder and named around 20 of its alleged leaders. Korac said one of the prime suspects is an associate of the State Security Service. Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic was the chief organizer of the October 2000 revolution that toppled Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. He became prime minister when the coalition swept to victory in parliamentary elections in January 2001. Djindjic eventually handed over Milosevic to the war War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague in return for $1.2 billion in economic aid. He had many enemies because of his pro-Western market-oriented reforms. He pursued a reform program the World Bank called the most rigorous pursued anywhere in post-communist Europe. Gingrich was often criticized for seeking too much power and for mercilessly fighting his rivals. His rivals called him Little Slobo. The U.S. Supreme Court last night granted a stay of execution to death row prisoner Delma Banks 15 minutes before Texan officials were set to kill him by lethal injection. We'll have more on that in a minute. The Bush administration claimed yesterday it was within close range of majority support for a UN resolution to attack Iraq. This, according to a report in the Washington Post. Five council members, including France and Russia, have said publicly they will not support what they see as unjustified rush to war, while only four, the U.S., Britain, Spain, and Bulgaria, are publicly behind it. The U.S. has refused to state what other countries are backing them. Washington is insisting on a Security Council vote by Friday whether or not they have the necessary votes. International relief organizations in the Middle East say they've neither sufficient supplies nor enough money to cope with the millions of injured, displaced, and starving people that could result in a war in Iraq. They fear at least half the Iraqi population of 25 million might be left struggling for food and water. And after days of media speculation that Iraq had developed a high-tech pilotless drone warplane, foreign journalists are now saying the fear may have been quite overstated. A New York Times reporter who saw the alleged drone compared it to the Wright brothers' plane. The paper reports, quote, "Resting on trestles on a sidewalk, the drone seemed like a sad, patched-together affair. Its two tiny engines, each about the size of a whiskey bottle and attached to minuscule wooden propellers, looked about powerful enough to drive a weed whacker, as one WAG present suggested. Like a primitive biplane from the earliest days of flight, its wings and twinned tail fins were made of wood and stretched fabric. Swaths of plastic masking tape covered the wing joints." Iran and Iraq have agreed to release all remaining prisoners from the country's war that ended in 1988. Iran is set to release 941 Iraqi prisoners of war, while Iraq will free 349 Iranians. The Philippine military has killed at least 16 members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front in airstrikes in the southern Philippines. A Turkish court has banned the country's main Kurdish party, the People's Democracy Party. The court also banned 46 members of the party, including the former chair, from politics for 5 years. The court claimed the party had been aiding the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which had previously been outlawed. The move follows a ruling on Wednesday by the European Court of Human Rights that the Turkish authorities violated the human rights of Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, who is serving a life sentence. And Japan has sent a battleship to the Sea of Japan amid reports that North Korea could be preparing another missile test. An Air Force base in Texas responsible for training intelligence specialists and firefighters experienced a surge in cases last year involving sex between instructors and students, this according to Air Force officials. This resulted in court-martial proceedings against four instructors and one student. The disclosure comes in the wake of reports of dozens of rapes and sexual assaults at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke was sentenced yesterday to more than a year in prison and a $10,000 fine for tax and mail fraud. And New York City yesterday became the 141st city and town in the country to pass a resolution condemning a war with Iraq. The nation's three largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, have now all passed anti-war resolutions.
When they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge.
Capital Punishment, Johnny Cash, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. The U.S. Supreme Court last night granted a stay of execution to death row prisoner Delma Banks 15 minutes before Texan officials were set to kill him by lethal injection. The Supreme Court justices said that Delma Banks should be kept alive in order for them to consider his request for a full hearing. Banks has long claimed that his 1980 trial was marred by prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective defense counsel, and racially discriminatory jury selection. Delma Banks is African American. He was convicted of killing a white teenager. He was convicted by an all-white jury. Former FBI Director William Sessions was among a number of others who have rallied behind Banks's case. Last night, soon after the decision came down, I got a chance to speak with Delma Banks's mother, Elian Banks, as she headed back in a van to her home.
I feel great. Thank the Lord. Hallelujah. It was just exciting. You know, when I heard it, it was just exciting, and I don't have the words to explain. I'm just so thankful that he got a stay. I wasn't up there. I was in another place. I wasn't right up there where it was, you know, but the witness was, I was waiting just to, you know, to witness the execution. And it came down from the Supreme Court that we got to stay.
What was your response when you heard the Supreme Court decision?
How did I feel? I started shouting, hallelujah, thank you, Jesus. I was excited.
Have you been able to talk to your son?
No, I haven't. Hopefully tomorrow, but I'm not sure.
Congratulations.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate your prayers. I had people praying everywhere. I mean, overseas. And I am so grateful and thankful that I have a lady that flew all the way from Belgium. That's one of my son's pen pals. He has several, and they were so nice. They've been so nice to us. And she just wanted to be here with the family. But she got an opportunity to visit with them. She flew all the way from Belgium. And people of prayer was praying everywhere. And God answered the prayers, and I'm so thankful. I can get a good night's rest tonight. It's been a long time since I slept all night, you know. But tonight I'm going to get me a good night's rest.
Elian Banks last night, just a few hours after the stay of execution of her son, Delma, as she was heading back in a van home. A few days ago, we took up this case and also played the comments of Delma Banks on death row in Texas as he talked about his mom.
So when I first got a date, I thought they were going to execute me. And I thought it was over, so I was pushing everybody away, you know, figuring that if they weren't so close to me, it wouldn't hurt as much. Wouldn't write nobody. Just trying to get everybody out of my life, thinking in my twisted mind that the further away from me, you know, the less it'll hurt. But my mom wouldn't let it go. She kept writing me, and she kept insisting. She'd tell me, she said, Look, if you ain't got nothing to say, just write and tell me you ain't got nothing to say. And she been at it for 20-some years. It finally got through. She the only one I couldn't push away. Just tell her I said I love her. And tell her I said thanks for being my mom.
Delma Banks, just a few days before his scheduled execution, which the Supreme Court stayed 15 minutes yesterday before he was to die. We're joined on the telephone right now by George Kendall, who's at the airport in Texas. He is Delma Banks' lawyer. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about what happened? Where were you when you heard about this stay?
Well, I was inside the prison in a little room with several members of Delma's family who had prepared themselves to witness Delma's execution. And it was almost 6 o'clock, and we'd not heard anything. And then a security officer came in and simply announced, very matter-of-fact, the stay has been granted, and you guys are free to leave. And so we just ran out of the building, and I was able to call one of my wonderful colleagues at the Legal Defense Fund, and she told me that we had gotten this stay from the Supreme Court right at the last minute. So we were, needless to say, overjoyed. I'm glad your viewers have been able to hear Mrs. Banks. You'll never meet a finer, nicer person than Mrs. Banks. She has been so committed to her family and son for all these years, and this has been just water torture for her. I took her out to dinner on Tuesday evening, and she said something to me that was just haunting. I have two young daughters, and I can't imagine what I would do, but she said, how do I go back to the prison tomorrow and say goodbye to my son? She has nothing but warm feelings for the victim's family in this case. She knows that they have gone through hell. The Banks family prays for the Whitehead family every day. And we hope at some point that that both families can have a resolution in this that does not result in Delma's execution, and the two families can begin to rebuild their lives.
We're talking to George Kendall, the attorney for Delma Banks, who is at the airport. Can you explain Delma Banks' case? What happened?
What happened was this, there was a young man's body was found in a park on a Monday morning, and the police quickly determined that Delma, who is three or four years older, the young victim was a white male who was 16 years old. Richard Whitehead was his name. My client at the time, Delma, was 21. They'd been together on the prior Friday evening, and my client's black, he's white, and the police began to try to build a case against Delma, and when they went to trial 6 months later, they had their case was based in large part upon two men who were drug addicts, one of whom was an informant for the police who was paid for his services in this case, and a second who had two prior felony convictions and was being held in jail on a third, facing a life sentence in Texas. And there was great pressure put on that witness to incriminate Delma at the guilt phase, and the paid informant was the crucial witness at the sentencing phase. The prosecutors had promised to disclose what's commonly known as impeachment material that they had about these two witnesses. They'd assured trial counsel that they would, but they didn't. In fact, both witnesses lied and lied repeatedly before the jury, and the prosecutor in our society has a clear obligation when one of their witnesses lies, they have to correct that. Not only did the prosecutors in this case not correct it, they got up in closing argument at both the guilt phase of the trial and the punishment phase and assured the jury that these witnesses had told the total and complete truth. It took us 19 years, but we finally were able to get to these witnesses, and they finally said, you know, much of my testimony at this trial was not truthful. I feel badly about this. Both executed a sworn affidavit. One of them actually came and testified at a hearing we had in federal court in 1999. And this testimony prompted a federal district judge in Texarkana in the year 2000 to vacate Delma's death sentence. However, the state appealed that, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals in New Orleans, reinstated that. But the prosecutors also, they made sure that there was an all-white jury in this case. There were four qualified African-Americans in the pool who could have sat in fairly for both sides in this case. They were all struck. And in getting into this case, we were able to find that in the five-year period prior to this case, leading right up to this case, that the prosecutors had routinely, in case after case after case, removed African Americans from felony juries. In fact, it was so stark that while the prosecutors would accepted more than 80% of the white jurors, they struck more than 90% of the black jurors. And this was a case where my client, mid-jury selection, slid a note over to his defense lawyer and said, we need blacks on the jury. And his lawyer, who was the former district attorney, who knew what was going on, wrote down something, slid in her back, and said, the state will strike them all. Unfortunately, that lawyer did not object to this practice of discrimination, and the court since have been unwilling to review that very strong claim of intentional purposeful discrimination.
What does the Supreme Court ruling mean now?
More time to determine a couple of things. One is whether they are going to take the case. There are these claims of prosecutorial misconduct, racial discrimination, and there's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in this case that are supported by former FBI Director William Sessions and three other prominent former prosecutors and judges have urged the court to take this case because, in their words, is that we can't let this case be finally resolved in its present state. These issues cry out for further review, and justice is not going to be done if there's not further review. So we think in the next 2 to 4 weeks, the court will formally conference this case and decide either to take the case itself or send the case back to the Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans for further review, or they could say we're not going to take it and just deny review.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, George Kendall, the attorney for Delma Banks. He is at the airport in Texas. Delma Banks got a stay of execution from the U.S. Supreme Court 15 minutes before he was scheduled to die yesterday at 6 p.m. Texas time, the busiest death row in the country. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Wade in the Waters, Fisk Jubilee Singers here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday in Salt Lake City, 15-year-old Elizabeth Smart was reunited with her families 9 months after she was abducted from her bedroom in the middle of the night. Police officials said Elizabeth was discovered after they were led by several tips to a man they identified as Brian David Mitchell. He had been a suspect for months. He once worked in the Smart home as a handyman. Mitchell and his wife were taken into custody on suspicion of aggravated kidnapping. Elizabeth was taken on June 5th of last year. A month earlier, another girl disappeared. Her name was Alexis Patterson. She was 7 years old and lived in Milwaukee. I just want to read from a piece, June 14th, 2002, that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Two girls are missing. The national media flocked to Salt Lake City to tell the nation about Elizabeth Smart. Why haven't the reporters descended on Milwaukee to tell the nation about Alexis Patterson? Two cases, two cities, two different stories. In Milwaukee, a 7-year-old girl disappears on May 3rd after setting off for High Mount Community School on West Garland Ave in the central city. In Salt Lake City, a 14-year-old is apparently kidnapped at gunpoint from her family's million-dollar home on June 5th. Patterson is featured in short snippets on the TV show America's Most Wanted, CNN and Fox News. Otherwise, the story receives scant national attention, no stories in the New York Times or the Washington Post. The Times and Post both send reporters to Salt Lake City to write about Elizabeth Smart. There are stories about her in the Boston Globe, the Miami Herald, newspapers as far away as Sydney, Australia. MSNBC provides hourly updates. The case is featured on CNN's Larry King Live, CNBC, MSNBC show Hardball with Chris Matthews. A Nexus search of major newspapers and magazines shows 67 stories about Patterson, almost all of them by the Associated Press or the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In the last week, there have been more than 400 stories about Smart. There is another difference between the two cases that cannot be ignored. Smart is white, Patterson black. This is the beginning of the piece by Mark Johnson and Anissa Johnson. Again, it was written last June 14th, 2002. We're joined by Anissa Johnson on the phone. Welcome to Democracy Now! Well, I think the story that you're telling was underscored last night by Ed Smart, Elizabeth's dad, when he came out after seeing his daughter for the first time in 9 months and thanked what he felt was the most important factor.
Media has played an incredible part in helping us bring her home. And I'm just so, so thankful.
That was Ed Smart. What about the media, Anissa Johnson? Who gets covered and who doesn't?
Well, we merely raised the question, does race matter in coverage? And I think no one can ignore that race is an issue, but what we found was that it's much more complex than that. Just the very question caused some people to bristle. Some news media outlets immediately said it has nothing to do with it. Some wouldn't even come to the phone or respect the question with an answer. A lot of people pointed out that the stories are different in a way. She was taken from her home at gunpoint. That the police ability to work with the media is a factor. What you saw in Salt Lake was this very savvy media machine. The parents knew how to work it. They had press conferences around the clock. The police knew how to deal with the media. It could be argued here in Milwaukee that there's a kind of a confrontational relationship between the police and the media. There was video of the Smart girl, and you didn't see that in Milwaukee. You don't see that of Alexis. But I think everyone would acknowledge that race and class matter.
We're also joined on the phone by Beverly Williams, who's a member of the Milwaukee NAACP, who attempted to get the national media to take up the case of Alexis Patterson. What happened, Beverly Williams?
It was very difficult. When we initially participated with Operation LAP and searching for Alexis, we had a plan. And on our plan was to contact the national media. So once we started doing that, we thought it would be easy, and they would immediately come to Milwaukee, provide coverage, national coverage for the disappearance of Alexis, but that did not happen. It was very frustrating calling many of the national outlets, and it took a long time for them to finally do something, and I credit that to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel here in Milwaukee for writing a story on the disparity of news coverage.
One of the things that was interesting that we heard after that, and I've really started to look at national news coverage in this way since then, is that there is this coastal bias that if it doesn't happen in either a coastal city or a prominent city, and Salt Lake at the time was very much in the news, that it's almost ignored, that the Midwest in some ways is ignored.
I don't think it's so much regional. I think it's race and class.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that when Alexis was missing, we found out there were many other African-American children who were missing, who had not received national coverage. Jahi Turner, Diamond and Tyonda Bradley were missing right in Chicago. Here in Milwaukee, that's right next door, we had never heard about these children missing. So I think it had more to do with race and class more so than region.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
We're also joined on the telephone by John Robbins Wills, who's president of Operation LAP, which formed after the disappearance of Alexis Patterson. What does it stand for, Operation LAP, John Robbins Wills?
Operation LAP originally was organized and put together. The LAP stood for Locate Alexis Patterson. We have since incorporated the organization and amended that to be Operation LAP Recovery Center Incorporated, and the LAP now stands for Location Assistance Professionals.
And how did you get involved with the case?
I was asked by a gentleman who actually founded the group, Keith Martin, to assist him because he learned that I had investigative experience. I'd owned a detective agency for almost 30 years. Law enforcement and military intelligence experience. And he come to me and he says, you know, I could really use some consulting help or something and some guidance on how to do searches, how to do what we're trying to do here. He says, I really don't know from a professional angle or anything how to do this. He says, my background is being a prison guard and he says, can you help me? And finally, I agreed to come in and assist.
And now, any leads? How far have you come in this investigation? And what has been the cooperation of the Milwaukee police?
Well, the Milwaukee police have shut me out more than I've ever been shut out anywhere in my about 40 years' experience. I've been an investigator since 1968. I date back to working on the original Adam Walsh case. And, I've had cooperation with departments all over where they basically kind of open the doors, open the book. Milwaukee, not a word. I give them leads and tips. I can't even find out if they're any good.
Beverly Williams, I know you have to go, member of the Milwaukee NAACP. You tried to get national media attention. I mean, one of the things that certainly made Elizabeth's face well-known all over the country, and again, her father and her uncles repeatedly said the media was the absolute key. In the end, it was tips of citizens nearby Sandy, Utah, who recognized her face, even though she was wearing a wig. It was the constant coverage, among other places, Larry King, following on a regular basis this story. Did you ever attempt to get on his show?
Yes. We attempted to go get on every national network, every national show within the United States. Yes, we did. We tried diligently. I mean, I have documentation. I have letters that I send to every network. We really tried. CNN, they did. CNN came to Milwaukee. Maybe another, CNBC or something, they came to Milwaukee to cover the story. But we sent letters to every national outlet in Milwaukee. And when we would tell them that an African-American girl was missing, just a young lady was missing, and give them information about the young lady, there was not a lot of interest initially. So we were shocked when we tried to get national coverage. We felt that, although Elizabeth Smart and I blessed, I think her family is truly blessed that she has come home, although she was missing a month after Alexis Patterson, we thought it was going to be very simple to get national coverage, but it was not. It was not simple at all.
What was the response of the media?
Basically, when I would call the stations, I would kind of get the runaround. When I would speak to, you know, I would have to do a lot of, I had to be very aggressive as far as trying to get to some type of executive or the assistant to the news producer, you know, and speak with them and, you know, just ask, plead with them to at least show her picture on the news. So it was very frustrating. Very frustrating. And they gave us coverage for a little while, but then, you know, of course, it has died down. And as I said, I think the Smarts are truly blessed that their daughter is home, and my prayers are with them as they go through the healing process. But we would also like Alexis Patterson returned to our community.
There was a dramatic sort of representation of what we're talking about today in the Division program on Lifetime that is about women cops. And there was a black woman cop who was dealing with the case of a young Latino girl that was gone, and she was with her mother and trying to investigate the case. And then a little white girl disappeared and was kidnapped, and the city poured resources and detectives into that case. Mm-hmm. And here was this lone cop who was begging for anything, any kind of attention for the Latino family. And right. Finally, she was able to get one concession, and that was a DNA test. And again, this was just a fiction drama, although it's often based on headlines. And in the end, they were able to get a DNA test, and it turned out that the guy who had murdered the little Latino girl went on to murder the little white girl, and that they, if they had paid attention in her case,
right.
Both possibly the other girl would have been saved.
Right, right. As I said before, I feel that the Smarts had a lot of resources. Of course, Alexis Patterson's family, they do not have a lot of resources. They're middle-class people. So I think, as I stated before, race and class play a major part in national news coverage, major part.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Beverly Williams, member of the Milwaukee NAACP. Anissa Johnson, staff reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And John Robbins Wells, president of Operation LAP, which formed after the disappearance of Alexis Patterson, who's been missing now for 10 months. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is the War and Peace Report. Here in New York City, as we move to another subject, the City Council has voted to approve a resolution opposing war with Iraq, except as a last resort. New York, Chicago, Los Angeles are the three largest cities in the U.S., and all three have now endorsed the anti-war resolution. The 31-17 vote came after months of debate over whether New York should stake out a position. Councilman Alan Gerson, a Democrat who voted for the resolution, whose district includes the World Trade Center, where over 3,000 people were killed in the September 11th attacks, said, "We of all cities must uphold the preciousness and sanctity of human life." Last month, 100,000 to 350,000 people joined hundreds of thousands others in anti-war protests near the United Nations. Recent polls show that 75% of New Yorkers oppose a war without the support of the UN. Since last September, anti-war resolutions have been approved in many cities like Cleveland, Ohio, Portland, Maine, Denver, Colorado, Oakland, California, Santa Fe, New Mexico, St. Paul, Minnesota, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Bill Perkins is with us right now as a city council member who spearheaded this resolution. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm very pleased that New York City has joined over 140 other cities of America under the banner of Cities for Peace, which would probably bring us up to a third of the Americans having spoken out against the Bush administration's a drumbeat to war. Very, very significant, because it's no longer what he would dismiss as a focus group. It is now the voice, the will of the people. And in a democracy, which he claims that he's trying to establish in Iraq, you listen to the voice of the people.
Okay, how did you do it?
We did it with...
How did it start? Who came up with
the idea? It started, frankly, with an effort to try to replicate on the city council level what Congressman Charles Rangel and the other members of the congressional delegation were doing in October to try to prevent the Congress from supporting the unilateral empowerment of the president to declare war. And I want to thank him and his staff for their inspiration and their assistance in crafting the original version of the resolution 549. And once that was submitted and to the council, for a while it was stalled, because I must say that I believe there was an effort to try to put our head in the sand and pretend that this was not a matter of great importance to the people of the city of New York. But I'll tell you, catalytic in moving it was the 500,000 people that came out on February 15th under the banner of the United of the organization United for Peace and Justice, and the attack on the civil liberties of the people of the city of New York when the mayor decided that we could no longer march, that we were forced to have a demonstration in pens that resulted in a substantial number of people having confrontations with the police and being arrested. So I think that the resistance on the part of the administration, coupled with the support of the Bush administration in the lawsuit, raised the consciousness of people that they had to come out, and subsequently raised the consciousness of the members of the council that we had to take a position. So it was the voices without that influenced those of us within the city council. And I think that's a very significant expression of how democracy works in our city. It's if the voices from outside of the council are raised and focused, then it can have a great influence on those of us who are inside of the council.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Bill Perkins, New York City Council member. You talked about United for Peace and Justice. There's going to be another major march in New York. I shouldn't say another, because the city didn't give a permit the first time. They've given a permit this time. Is that
That's
right?
That's a victory. They have conceded to the fact that they are not doing the right thing by denying New Yorkers the opportunity to march, and that there's a significant hypocritical aspect to this when, in fact, marches are allowed throughout the year for any number of reasons, but they generally are not reasons in which there's a political agenda that the administration opposes. And in this case, they've learned that they cannot be discriminatory about marches and the licenses to march, that they have to allow people, whether they agree with us or not, to fulfill their civil liberties.
Well, March 22nd is the scheduled march in New York, and March 15th is a major march in Washington. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
You are listening to Democracy Now! And this whole movement, Cities for Peace. The website is www.citiesforpeace.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk to the man who Pentagon advisor Richard Perl has called the closest thing to a terrorist in this country. He is investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. Stay with us.
It's the people who made America great. It's the people who are the electorate. Five people gave me Florida on a silver plate. I trust the people. Oh, the people they earn with the sweat of their toil. Sometimes the people the earth do despoil. My people, they do it with petroleum oil. I trust the people. I trust the people through and through. I don't trust the government, and neither should you. I trust the people, compassionate me. Now I'm the government. Can I trust me? Now the people know that forests are not just scenery. My people, they want to save their.
And I trust the people. Words and music by Greg Artzner and Terry Leonino. here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, Pentagon advisor Richard Perle called him, quote, the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist. Then Perle threatened to sue him in Britain for libel. The man is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, investigative reporter in The New Yorker, which published his latest piece, Lunch with the Chairman, Why Richard Perle's Meeting with Adnan Khashoggi. Perle is the chair of the Defense Policy Board, a Pentagon advisory board. He's been one of the leading advocates for war in Iraq. He's also the managing partner of a venture capital company called Trireme Partners. The firm invests in companies dealing in technology, goods, and services that are of value to homeland security and defense. Now Perle is threatening to sue because Seymour Hersh implied he may be using his position as a Pentagon advisor to benefit financially from a war with Iraq. Well, Seymour Hersh joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now! I think it's interesting that we hear Richard Perle saying you're the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist at the same time that you've just returned from Harvard University, where you accepted the Goldsmith Career Award for Excellence in Journalism at the Kennedy School of Government's ARCO Forum.
Yeah, that's a terrorism outfit, I think. I guess. I'm a Harvard, you know, it seems to me. That is ironic, yes. He didn't think it through, to put it mildly.
Well, can you talk about the piece that you wrote in The New Yorker about Adnan Khashoggi and Richard Perle?
Well, here's the thing. The thing that's significant, Trireme puts out a piece of paper. Trireme's a venture capital company that was organized after 9/11 to invest in Homeland Security devices, not against the law. Nobody's suggesting anything like that. And they're looking for money, big money. They've raised money from Boeing. They've raised about $45 million, according to an internal document somebody gave me. And in this document, which was sent to people like Khashoggi, wealthy people from whom they wanted a lot of money, I think they wanted $100,000 from Khashoggi to get into the game. They, in their own document, they state sort of triumphantly, they trumpet this: three of Trireme's management group members currently advise the U.S. Secretary of Defense by serving on the U.S. Defense Policy Board. And one of Trireme's principals, Richard Perle, is chairman of the board. The other two, one of the other people, by the way, is Henry Kissinger. But we can leave that to the side. But so here is Perle, a company which Perle is a partner, advertising to potential investors his connection. And that's all you need to say about it, because one of the things that's interesting is, under the code of conduct, Perle is not a paid government employee. The Defense Policy Board is an advisory group, but he is chairman. He certainly has made that group very much. It's been a bully pulpit from him for his views on the war. And I think you'd have to say, of all the people that for the last 10 years have been advocating going after Saddam above everything else, he's sort of the leader of the pack. And two or three of his closest friends, Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Douglas Feith, number three man in the Pentagon, the undersecretary, have all shared the same views with him for years, a decade. So, and one of the things about Perle these group, the Wolfowitz, Feith, and he have in common is they're all very pro-Israel. And they actually believe, and I think they do believe, going into Iraq and then Iran will make things better for Israel and perhaps even make peace possible, convince the Palestinians that they must get rid of Arafat. This is the language you hear from them, to rationalize it. And Perle has been incredibly outspoken in his hostility towards Saudi Arabia. And after 9/11, he stepped it up. The Saudis, he said, were financiers of terrorism. The Saudis are known as a country that pay off people that scare them and alarm them. That's what they do. That's certainly what they did with the terrorists. Osama bin Laden, what do you need to go to Afghanistan? Here's money. That's the way it works for them, and it has for a decade or two. And so he's been yelling about that, not without some correctness. He's also been very hostile to Crown Prince Abdullah, the head of Saudi Arabia, the titular head anyway, his efforts to get a peace going between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The Saudis have been pushing very hard, collaterally with the war on terrorism, to get peace going, obviously, in the point of view, the rational point that will help us in our war. So that's what Perle is. And then I discover, I'm told by people, I'm giving this sort of recruitment letter that Trireme has been sending around to potential investors, and I hear that Richard had a meeting in Marseille about an hour from his summer home in Provence with two wealthy Saudis. And the first thing, I didn't know whom. The thing that's amazing about it is, of course, for Richard Pearl to go to Saudi Arabia and get $100 million or ask for that kind of money or be involved in a program. He didn't directly ask, but he was certainly involved, as people tell me, as the closer in the deal for the $100 million. He was the example of trireme's clout. Raises questions almost of a shakedown. You know, that's, you know, because everybody knows implicit in this, and maybe Pearl didn't understand that, but the Saudis, as I quote him as saying, certainly understood that if you give Pearl $100 million, maybe he'll go away and stop being so critical. And then I discover that the guy he met with was Adnan Khashoggi, who in the 1980s became famous or infamous in America as the middleman in this crazy scheme that Ronald Reagan and Oliver North, those names, came up with of trading arms. They were going to sell arms to Iran in return for the release of the hostages. Only, of course, the American public didn't know that the hostages were coming out because of secret arms we supplied. And Khashoggi was the middleman in that. He's also was known as one of the big high flyers in the late 60s and early 70s, sort of the great payola guy. He was the Saudi royal kingdom began to invest in arms and weapons and airplanes. And he was the broker, often, you know, had enormous kickbacks to him, or payola, what you will, or commissions, as he might describe it. And he was written about in the 70s with his as sort of a jet-set Saudi entrepreneur, private planes, 8 homes fully staffed, always on phone, telephones, always beautiful woman, et cetera, et cetera. So Pearl, just the mere fact that Pearl met with Khashoggi is, for me, a story. Period. And so there we are. And then to find out that one of the things Pearl was doing, Khashoggi's job was to bring some wealthy Saudis to the table so they would invest in trireme. And the cover for the meeting, the cover story, in case anybody discovered it, is that Pearl and Khashoggi and the other wealthy Saudis were having a lunch to talk about foreign policy, how to end the war or how to get Saddam out short of war, which is, I quote people as saying in the article, nothing more than just a convenient pretext for what really was a business meeting. End of story.
Seymour Hersh, his piece in The New Yorker is called Lunch with the Chairman. Why was Richard Pearl meeting with Adnan Khashoggi? We see Richard Pearl on, it seems, every network. Can you say how you feel he should be described in terms of what he has to gain from his advocacy for war with Iraq? How should reporters introduce him?
Well, look, you know, let me just tell you what somebody said. Khashoggi was quoted as saying to me, this is a guy who's, not, you know, obviously an advocate. And by the way, let's make it clear. I actually like Richard because he's one of the few people in Washington for somebody like me who's obviously got a point of view that's different in terms of the policy of this administration. He's always been available to me. He's always been willing to be quoted. And if you look at the stories I've written in the last since 9/11, he's probably been quoted 4 or 5 times on the record in New Yorker pieces. He's always been somebody who's there. He's also, as you say, he's on TV all the time. He's a proselytizer. He's the guy making the case that a lot of people in the government want to make, but he can do it better. He's very articulate. He's very sure. He's very bright. He's been around for a long time. He's nominally a Democrat. He was worked for Senator Scoop Jackson, the anti-communist Democrat. Nobody can question that Richard Pearl really believes going into Iraq is important, and no amount of business has anything to do with that feeling. The same for his strong feelings about Israel. The problem is that one of the things about the code of conduct for people in his position, the government code, the ethical code, is you can't put yourself even in a position of being an appearance of conflict. And by also being in business, in a business that whose success depends, you could argue, on war. And Adam Khashoggi said to me, Khashoggi, one thing he's not is a fool. He's quite a brilliant, interesting guy. I flew to Paris or to Nice the other night, overnight, to see him and have dinner with him because I wanted to be sure I understood the context of the meeting. And he was on the record saying that Pearl's the kind of guy, you know, that if there's a war, it's good for business. And that's the problem. And he thinks, he makes fun of America. He thinks we're very much hypocrites. We always pretend that somehow we separate business from influence. And he describes Pearl in on the record in my article, it's an influence peddle. Of course he is. He said that's what people in that position do. Well, that's not how Pearl sees himself. He actually sees himself as somebody who, noblesse oblige, who's doing a committed work. He's an idealist doing the right thing for the right reasons, and the fact that he has some business has nothing to do with anything. And that's the issue. The issue is whether or not there should be some standard to which he and others should be held to, even if it's even of appearance is the point.
Well, now Richard Pearl says he is going to sue you in a British court. I should say we reached him at his home last night. Our producer, Mike Burke, talked to him. He said he wouldn't come on the program today, but did confirm that he's in discussions with his attorneys about filing a libel suit in Britain against you. He said your article contains many lies, but refused to comment on what was libelous in the article. Can you talk about why he's pursuing a libel case if he does? In a British court?
Well, because in the United States, of course, we have this wonderful standard that was the Supreme Court adopted in the 60s, the New York Times versus Sullivan. It's the standard of malice. He has to prove in the U.S. that I maliciously and intentionally published information I knew to be wrong. In other words, in America, we can be stupid as reporters, and as long as we're not maliciously stupid, we can't be guilty of libel. He's a public figure, and he's held to a high public standard. In England, presumably, that same standard doesn't exist, but I have to tell you, I've been in litigation. Amy, I've been in litigation since 1969 on libel law with the same wonderful lawyer, a guy named Michael Nussbaum in Washington, who's been my lawyer for everything. And I've been in litigation in London on this. And I can tell you that, I shouldn't say it, but, I'm not going to lose sleep about it. One of the quotes that drives him crazy is, I did see, and this I know from his conversations with various people in Washington, the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Prince Bandar, has been here for 20 years. He's one of these sort of fabled characters. His father is the Sultan. I've written about him in very negative ways. I did an article a year ago describing how the Sultan and is one of the great payola guys, grafters of all time, is everybody in the royal family. Every contract, got a huge kickback to the royal family. That's how they make their keep it going. Anyway, Bandar saw me about this. He learned independently that I was doing this story and through a third person, had me call him. I've never interviewed him before. I trot over to his house, and on the record, he says the following. On the record, he says, for example, one of the quotes that I know Richard's upset about is, quote, there is a split personality to Pearl, Obama said. Here he is on one hand trying to make a $100 million deal, and on the other hand, there were elements of the appearance of blackmail. Quote unquote, if we get in business, he'll back off on Saudi Arabia. And he says, as for the meeting in Paris, the alleged meeting about politics, he said, Paul Bander also said, there has to be a deniability in the cover story. A possible peace initiative in Iraq is needed. I believe the Iraqi rents are irrelevant. A business meeting took place. These are devastating quotes. And you can be sure the New Yorker, with its fact-checking, was extremely careful in all of the quotes, not only with Bander, but also with Khashoggi, and also I did interview the businessman. There was a businessman at the lunch named Zuhair, very eminent, wealthy Saudi. I guess that's an oxymoron, I'm wealthy Saudi. But anyway, hundreds of millions of dollars in assets, and he was willing to put up $100 million, collect a group of guys each to put up $10 million, and that's why he was there. He was there to hear Pearl out about the war and to contribute if needed.
Seymour Hersh, we only have 50 seconds, but I wanted to get your comments when you received the Goldsmith Career Award for Excellence in Journalism at the Kennedy School at Harvard. You began your acceptance speech by portraying the difficulties that today's reporters face, especially in Washington. You're quoted in the Harvard Crimson as saying, I have never seen my peers as frightened as they are now. There is no real standard of integrity because the White House doesn't have any. It's scary, you said. Is that true?
No, actually what I did is I began by expressing amazement. I did say that, but my first sentence was I expressed amazement that we didn't begin the meeting with a prayer, since we are getting close to theocracy here. So there you are. Ha, 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 right? Yes, I said that, and yes, I believe it. The fear they have is not, it's self-censorship. That's the issue. We're afraid to say what we really think and believe, and we had a news conference in which a group of reporters were like puppeteers. The president is calling them off. And I'll tell you something, if I had been there, Which I wouldn't have been.
Real fast.
If I'd been there, I would have stood up and said, you know, they bypassed the Washington Post reporter, Dana Milbake, who wrote a story about the president telling untruths. I would have stood up and said, I want to turn my question over to the Washington Post guy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Seymour Hersh, New Yorker. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for this expanded two-hour edition of Democracy Now!
Brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary.